Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Spectators podcast. I'm Kate Andrews. As the government doubles down on its commitment to hit net zero carbon emissions by 2050, there's a lot of anticipation and questions about what this might mean as we go about our daily lives. The future of transport is no exception. Having already announced a ban on the sale of petrol cars by 2030, it's an area where the government is hoping to make relatively quick advancements and efficiencies. But at what cost? Joining me today to discuss the hopes and hurdles for greener transport infrastructure, we have the Minister from the Department of Transport, Rachel McLean, MP, Roger Hunter, VP for Electric Mobility at Shell, and Professor David Levinson, a civil engineer at the University of Sydney. This podcast is kindly sponsored by Shell. David, when it comes to the future of transport, what qualities are on the wish list? We can talk about some of the challenges in getting there in a bit, but for now, can you paint a picture of what the future of transport should look like?
Yeah, so the future of transport should be efficient, it should be safe, it shouldn't have significant environmental impacts, it should be convenient for people, it should be an experience that they want to have, that they get pleasure from. So the transport system today doesn't meet those criteria very well, right? So we have a system where we're stuck in traffic, a system where more than 1 million people die a year in road crashes globally. We have a system that is one of the leading contributors to climate change and causes lots of premature deaths from air pollution. A system that is the least happy experience that people have during their day. So there's a lot of opportunities for improvement.
Rachel, the government has an ongoing future of transport program. What kinds of things is it looking into?
Well, I think David has just set out the challenge really well. For this government, the number one challenge outside of the pandemic, of course, and recovering from that, is very much the climate change agenda and getting to net zero. And transport has a massive part to play in that. And so if we are going to truly get to net zero in transport, we have to fundamentally change the way that we travel, the way that we get our goods. And I think that technology can play a huge role in that. And what's exciting to me is that we in the UK are world leaders in a lot of this stuff, at the engineering, at the software development, and we have a real chance to take that leadership position. And that can be a massive advantage for the UK as well, in terms of just thinking about coming out of the pandemic and the focus on jobs for the future. This can be a real enabler for people and also play into our levelling up agenda as well. So I think it's quite broad, but I think it's absolutely vital that we do have a very proactive approach to the future of transport as a government.
Rachel, one of the most immediate changes to the future of transport is going to be this ban on petrol cars by 2030, which the government has mandated. What would a future where electric vehicles are everywhere look like? It's going to take a lot more infrastructure than we have now, isn't it?
Yeah, and Kate, I just want to just say right from the start, this is not a ban, this is an end of sale. So people, if they still have those diesel and petrol cars at 2030, they'll still be able to drive them. We're not expecting them to take them off the roads, but we have made it very clear that we will expect manufacturers to stop selling them. And what's been fascinating since we made that announcement, actually, is that the industry have responded and have leapt ahead, if you like, of the government. And a lot of them have come out and said, well, actually, we think we can go faster. We think we can electrify our entire product range by 2025. We're even seeing, for example, the whole Formula One industry getting involved in this particular space and making electric motoring not only the right thing to do, but also the cool and fun thing to do. It's an aspirational thing to do. So I think we're already starting to see that shift. The infrastructure, you're right, is vital to this. We're making good strides. We have pledged that we will put a lot of government investment behind that. And actually, one of my top things in my inbox right now is working on the infrastructure strategy that we need to have, because we do need to have more charging infrastructure. The government has a role in that, and we set out how we'll do that. But we're also seeing the private sector coming in here. We're seeing investment going into very high profile businesses such as GridServe, who are taking a stake in Ecotricity. We're going to see a huge transformation of the existing infrastructure and building on that as well.
Roger, David mentioned that flexibility and ease for passengers was going to be a key feature of the future of transport. Can you talk a little bit about shared mobility, what this means, and what sort of shared options might consumers see in the future?
Yeah, sure. This concept of shared mobility has been around, what, for about 5 or so years at scale. And, you know, everything from the fact that you can access a taxi from your app to the fact that you can access an e-bike or a regular bike or even in many places an e-scooter. We see schemes nowadays where you can pick up an electric moped and, you know, you take it for a spin, do your journey and then drop it off. And, you know, you've essentially shared the use of that asset. We also see the actual sharing of seats in vehicles. We see schemes like what Via Transportation Inc. do, where you're essentially using a demand responsive way of accessing the vehicle. You know where it's going to be. You can see its position. You go to a virtual bus stop, so it's great. You use your legs for a bit. And then you get into the minibus and you've got a seat reserved for your part of the journey, and you hop off when you want, and you automatically pay for the miles you've travelled. You know, that's sharing seats in a vehicle as well. So it's not just sharing vehicles, it's sharing seats in vehicles. And what's lovely is this introduction of actually new form factors of vehicles, like I say, the e-scooters. So you've got a real mixed bag of shared options for moving people. Now, what's also incredibly exciting is you can share in terms of the moving of goods as well. I mean, many vehicles today, vans or large trucks, are empty. And you see a rise of platforms. Rachel mentioned it about digital technology and software. You see a rise of platforms where you can share not just the vehicle, but you can share space in vehicles and use backhauls when vehicles are empty. I think it's hugely exciting. And it's really kind of relatively low barriers to getting this stuff done. The reason being is the infrastructure is already there. Vans already making that journey anyway. So I think these are the sort of gains that are going to make a real difference in terms of better utilization of the assets that we've got in play and we put in play in the future.
David, could there be added benefits for city planning and how we live in cities? So we're going to need a lot more infrastructure for, say, electric cars, more charging points. But then on the other side, we might need fewer parking spaces. Could this free up land to be used for other things?
Yeah, I think we waste a lot of space in the transport sector. Okay, so when Roger was talking about sharing, and when we think about a vehicle, a typical car has at least 4 or 5 seats in it, and only one of those is used. SUVs, sport utility vehicles, might have 7 seats, and only one of those is used. We park these cars, and they're not in motion 23 hours out of the day. So any kinds of efficiencies that we can gain by using our fleet more efficiently so we have fewer vehicles on the road, using our vehicles more efficiently so that the seats that are in those vehicles are more fully occupied, and ideally so that the vehicles are smaller and right-sized to the number of people who are traveling, right? So if you're moving one person, the vehicle really only needs to have 1 seat. If you're moving 2 people, the vehicle only needs to have 2 seats. It doesn't need to have 4 or 7. If we can come up with a system that better matches the transport infrastructure to the actual demands, we can free up a lot of space. And that space can be used for any number of things. It can be used for greening our cities, nice linear parks, building larger nature strips between footpaths and the street for the movement of vehicles, turning parking lots into development. So right now it's been estimated in many cities that more than 1/3 of the land is used as road space. And we probably need about 1/3 of that if we really used our system efficiently. So we could get transport uses down to 10% of our cities, freeing up 20% of the space in urban areas for other uses.
Rachel, a lot of the advancements that we've seen in technology have allowed people to have things more personalized, made more individual. Does this concept of shared mobility actually go hand in hand with people essentially wanting their own stuff?
I think so, absolutely. Because people want to choose. They want that freedom of flexibility to do things on their own terms at a time that suits them. And up until now, that has often been the private car, and it still is in many parts of the country. But I think the vision is, with some of the new technological solutions and some of the new ideas and some of the new platforms that David and Roger have mentioned, that does enable a real shift in that. It means that it could no longer be absolutely essential to own a private car in a big city in order to just to live your life the way that you want to, without any curtailments at all on your freedom, and in fact giving you more freedom because you don't have to worry about paying for a vehicle, or where do you park it, or the risk of it being stolen. And we're seeing a huge explosion of ideas and investment in this space. Government has a role to play. Of course, we need to think about the legislation. We need to think about how people are safe. And we also sort of need to be very mindful that it's one thing to do something in London or a big city, but what about if you live in a rural area and you haven't got those options? So that, in a sense, is what we need to do as government, to think about that we don't leave people behind and everybody has the same opportunity.
Rachel, you used an interesting phrase there. You said being able to live your life the way you want to. A lot of people have argued that the government could go much faster if it were harsher and crack down further on the lifestyles of people who would choose to own a private car in a big city when they don't necessarily need to. Public transport is everywhere. What does this government think the right balance is between getting to that net zero target and making sure that people's lifestyles don't change dramatically?
Well, we've been very clear in this government, I think, that we are absolutely laser-like focused on the net zero agenda. And we have actually been more ambitious under this government and since we've left the European Union than firstly many of our EU neighbours, and we are the only country to have set such ambitious targets for net zero so far and to have made legislative steps towards that and to have put government investment behind it. So we are crystal clear that that's where we're going to get. But we're also very clear that this is not the time, especially not now, for us to be saying to people, you have to stop doing the things that you love doing that enable you to work or see your family or even just enrich your own experience through travel, for example. We believe that there are technological solutions that will enable us to get to net zero. Of course, people always say, well, they're not there now. But since when has technology ever been here now to solve a problem that's 30 years in the future? So I'm incredibly confident and optimistic about it. We have to put government cash behind it, which we're doing. But we are already seeing massive changes here.
Well, speaking of technology that isn't quite there yet, Roger, there's also driverless cars to consider. Now, it's very exciting to be talking about this on a Spectator podcast. We don't often get to talk about driverless cars. But the tech isn't quite there yet, is it?
Well, this is the lovely thing, right, about if when COVID restrictions are lifted, etc., you know, and you can get on a plane and you can go to different parts of the world, it is at times like getting in a time machine. So if you get in a plane and get yourself across to Phoenix, you can be picked up by the driverless car from the airport, and you know, you can have a driverless experience. I had my first driverless experience actually in Las Vegas back in, I think it was maybe 2018 at the CES. So, you know, it does happen. You can fast forward today into the future and you can see this in action. Same in China, there's a number of trials, and we've even got some trials going on in the UK, which we should also be proud of. So there is a lot going on in the driverless world sort of ecosystem, and it will be here this decade. The key is, when will it be here at a commercial and material scale? You know, that's still a big question mark.
I mean, David, we have to manage expectations here. Even Elon Musk had to delay the Tesla rollout of driverless cars. He thought he was going to be at full automation by 2021. Well, we're here now, and he's far from it. So this isn't something we can really expect to have in the near future, is it?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the near future, right? So transport tends to have a long time scale. The average car on the road is 11 years old in North America. I imagine it's similar in the UK. And so turning over the fleet is something that's going to take a couple of decades. So even if tomorrow all new cars that were sold were autonomous, and obviously they won't be tomorrow, it would be two decades before we'd fully converted all the vehicles on the road. You can buy cars today that can be driverless on freeways in the United States. These are available for on the market from General Motors. And they've got a Super Cruise, and it's in their Cadillac and some of the other models. You can be hands-off. They do want you to be watching the road, right? So they've got cameras monitoring your eyes to make sure you're not falling asleep or watching a movie or something like that. But the car is driving itself. Now, it's not driving itself in a way that you can fall asleep quite yet. People have tried that to eventually their dismay in some of these vehicles. But we're getting there. It's not something that we're going to snap our fingers and one day all the vehicles are magically going to become driverless. But over the course of a couple of decades, we will get increasing automation in various aspects of the driving task, and you'll be able to go without actually having to pay attention to the driving task in front of you. And we will get to a point where we will turn off the last human-driven vehicle, just as like we don't have horses on our streets anymore. And though the world will be very different and the world will be safer and there'll be lots of other benefits as a result of that.
Rachel, is there a public perception problem, whether it's the reliability of electric vehicles or the safety of driverless cars? Eventually, there's going to need to be a big shift in public opinion to reach your targets.
Yes, and I often think these things happen imperceptibly. And, you know, if you look at anything, you talk about anything sort of 10 or 20 years ago, and people would be incredibly sceptical that you could have something the size of a massive mainframe computer that took up three rooms in your mobile phone. People say, oh, that's ridiculous, you're bonkers, that'll never work. And this is the same argument with the technology and the transport. I mean, there's a lot of sort of misconceptions about the automation issue. Self-driving is not the same thing as a driverless car. People have got this vision of like sort of pods driving around without a single person in them. Yes, that does exist in certain situations, and of course the technology is there. But what we've just legislated for in the UK is actually a very significant first step. We have just legislated for something called the automated lane keeping system, which is the first time that it will be legal when these vehicles come onto the roads that a human driver will not be actually required to have their hands on the wheel. Of course, cruise control and things like that already exist, but it's very clearly you're breaking the law if you take your hands off the wheel or don't pay attention. So this is, it's quite subtle, but it's a very, very big shift. We're the first country to sort of grasp some of these opportunities by legislating for this and by doing the work to get our legislation in place. And I think the key point here is that this is going to be so much safer. Again, it's really interesting how people think that this is a dangerous thing because humans aren't looking or paying attention. Actually, humans are the ones that cause the accidents. It is human error that causes most of the crashes or accidents on our roads. And of course, we have to make sure that the software is not faulty. But if you think about all the things now that are actually run by software in our daily lives, most of us don't even know it's going on, but most of our world is run by software, and we're not constantly worried that it's going to sort of blow up unless, you know, you think about the Y2K or something like that. So yeah, we're absolutely going to get there. It always takes quite a while because you have to take the public with you, you have to get the insurance right, and you have to just get people into the right mindset that it's going to be safe.
Roger, the best case scenario sounds great. You've got safer modes of transport, you've got more efficient modes of transport. Hopefully the driver, the passenger has to do far less work. But no one's sitting out there really believing that that comes with no cost. It sounds very pricey, very expensive. By 2030, when this ban on petrol cars, on buying petrol cars comes in, are we really going to be in a place where your average person can afford the new technology?
Well, I think we have to make a distinction around the things that take a lot of investment and those that are easier. And lower investment. And, you know, you've kind of got to put them in two buckets. I mean, for instance, on the high infrastructure and investment, you know, putting in public charging that's very high powered, you know, high voltage such that it charges your car in, say, 5 or 10 minutes, that's going to take a grid upgrade. That's going to take, you know, quite a bit of kit that has to be built in a really convenient location for folks. That's, you know, big piece of investment. And at the moment, with utilisation of electric vehicles being relatively low, as it's still quite early stage, you know, that's a big ask. Yeah. So those things are difficult decisions that need government and business and consumers to come together in order to make them happen. And of course, you know, that is happening around the world. And I think things like the direction that the UK government has provided is very, very helpful around things like the overall 2030 ICE ban that's come in. So, and again, that's not a ban of the actual vehicle, right? It's just the new vehicles, yeah, as Rachel mentioned. So that bit can be worked out. Now, there's the other piece, which is about the software, some of the easier things that can be done, yeah, the smarter way of moving goods and people, which don't require as much infrastructure and investment. And it is a bit like what David and others have said, you know, get that bit right. And so my advocacy here is do both. I mean, invest in the cleaner fuels and the cleaner electricity and moving people that way, but also invest in the smarter way of doing things as well.
Rachel, to come back on that cost point, though, when Boris Johnson made the big announcement about EVs last November, it came along with almost £2 billion worth of additional funding. Now, that's public money, that's taxpayer money. The taxpayer's being asked to fund quite a lot at the moment, especially in relation to our COVID recovery. The government may say, well, this is the priority, but at some point there's got to be some concept of trade-offs. This stuff is expensive.
Well, look, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to have the Chancellor of the Exchequer's job right now. And you're right, you know, the public finances are under an unprecedented strain, and we all know the reason why. But look, you know, we were elected on a mandate to level up the country. Levelling up the country takes taxpayer money, and people have voted for that. Because we've had the pandemic, that doesn't stop our focus on doing that. And in fact, we have to redouble our efforts to do it. And this agenda is slap bang square right in the middle of that levelling up agenda, because it does enable us to invest in those green technologies that are going to create those skilled jobs, those opportunities all over the country, and also position the UK as a leader in the world in the science and the investment and the engineering that's needed. So I'm really excited about it. This is going to be a net benefit for the UK. We're already seeing in response, and Roger rightly mentioned it, that signal that we sent to the market in terms of the 2030 phase out date, phase out, not ban, everyone, get on message, has already resulted in manufacturers bringing forward new models. The prices are coming down. The battery life is becoming much, much greater all the time, because we have the best engineers in the world and they're figuring out how to do this. So we expect to see price parity with EVs in the next few years, probably in the middle of this decade. And I think all this new technology is already coming a standard with vehicles. Of course, it will be affordable, just like our phones are affordable now. And you know, demand and supply, that's how it works.
Roger, there are clearly some technological barriers that we have to overcome. We've been talking about them in this podcast. What is the role to be played by the private sector and investors in funneling the right kind of talent and resources into these projects?
Well, you know, for me, it's really the future. You know, understanding these customer frictions well, and then coming up with software and hardware and infrastructure solutions to allow businesses and people to move themselves and their goods in a smarter and cleaner way is exactly what business should be investing in, because that's the future. I mean, that's where we're going. I mean, you know, skates are where the puck is going. So absolutely, businesses like Shell invest very much in the technology, both software and hardware, to make that happen. It gets accelerated through the role of governments and the role of experts and investors like David. When you think about kind of talent and where we're putting a lot of our growth investment in Shell, it's in these sort of areas. You know, we've got to make charging electric vehicles simpler and easier. We don't want it to be confusing for consumers, and we want it to be reliable, hugely reliable. When you go and plug in, it works. And it's just lovely the way that technology can knit things together now. So range anxiety for those who have an EV disappears relatively quickly. You have a charger at home. There's now an increasing amount of on-street chargers. We have chargers on the go, and we have apps and the dashboard within the car often that gives advice on where this public charging is. Battery life is getting longer. The costs are coming down and the density is improving, and the life of the actual batteries themselves is improving. So there's all these kind of improvement curves, and businesses are helping drive those to a better place. So yeah, huge responsibility for business. But as I say, when things are early stage, we do need that help of both the consumers and of course of regulators and policymakers in order to get there quicker.
David, it's been a long year, a painful year, but through the COVID pandemic, we've learned a lot about what can happen when regulators don't lower standards, but act faster and become nimble. The result has been multiple working vaccines, which are saving lives. Some people are now asking how these lessons might bleed into other areas. Could there be appetite in transport, for example, to throw out the rule book and speed up the process?
I think there's still an inherent conservatism about change, right? I mean, we have technologies that are potentially safer, but they have some risks, and people are as afraid of the risk at a way that might result in them having, you know, a greater risk of death than some other risk that they don't control, right? So you don't want to stick a vaccine in you if you know that there's some small side effect, even though it reduces the probability that you'll get some disease. And I think that's a fundamental problem with people's risk tolerance, that it's going to be hard to accelerate the advances in some of these things because of that kind of reluctance, right? Autonomous vehicles is an example. People are more worried about a death caused by a robot than they would be by 10 deaths caused by a human. And I mean, from a strictly rational perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but there's fears about control. People are more afraid of being in airplanes often than being in automobiles. And automobiles have a much higher death rate than airplanes do. And the aviation sector is much more heavily regulated. So I think we need to keep that in mind. I think we might learn to be a little bit more nimble, but we're not seeing massive deregulation in the drug sector for other diseases, just for COVID because of its urgency. But other diseases which have been around for a long time aren't seeing their potential treatments accelerated because of this necessarily. So, I mean, I wish that we would be a little bit more risk tolerant as a society, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Well, to end on an optimistic note, I want to ask all of you where you think the greatest gains are to be made in the future of transport. What are you most excited about? Roger, I'll start with you.
Well, look, so I look after electric mobility for Shell, right? So it's going to be no surprise. I think electrifying light duty transport and also much of heavier duty transport as well is going to be a huge gain for us as we green our grids, as we provide more renewable electricity across the different countries across the globe, really providing renewable electricity into transport and reducing local air emissions as well as carbon is a huge, huge opportunity for us. The technology is there. We're right on the cusp of this now. Things need to scale, but we're going in the right direction. I think that it's going to look very different in 10 years' time in terms of the vehicles moving around, not just the streets in the UK, but across the world.
David?
I'd vote for automation. I think that the introduction of robots into the transport sector have profound changes. And I mean, I think electrification is important too and will happen sooner. But the ability to replace trips with autonomous delivery vehicles, the ability for people who can't drive themselves now to have transport on demand, the ability to resize the fleet and have it come to you when you need a large vehicle, you get the large vehicle. When you need a small vehicle, you get a small vehicle, is really important. And I think the changes that will come with automation are being underestimated right now. I mean, the pace at which it was going to come, I think people are a little bit more optimistic than, you know, the technology is harder than they thought. But when it comes, it's going to have, society is going to look a lot more different because of it than with electrification, which will change the vehicles to be sure, but it's going to leave the fundamental travel patterns basically the same.
And Rachel?
Well, I'm going to be on the side of the consumer and better choice and freedom for people to do more in a cheaper way, in a more convenient and flexible way, and in a way that doesn't damage the planet, and in also a way that's better for their health. And whether that is more active travel, sort of built in seamlessly into your journey using e-scooters and shared bikes and so on, and from the other benefits to do with air quality, so that actually when you're going about your day, you're not inadvertently breathing dirty air. Because all of these technologies that we've got, whether it's electrification or whether it's green hydrogen, are all going to enable us to just have a more healthy and better life. And actually, in a sense, we're not picking winners here. We are just setting out where we need to go. And we know that the market and business, and we know ultimately people will come with us, even though they're reluctant and a bit scared and nervous. When they see the benefits, which they're already doing, we know that there will be a big, big tipping point and a big shift.
Rachel, Roger and David, thank you so much for joining me. And thanks again to Shell for sponsoring this podcast.